Chapter 25. 2028 Hours. A corridor extended in front of Bald and Porter for 15 meters. There were doors on either side of the corridor. Porter counted 5 in total, 2 on each side of the corridor. A fifth at the far end. Office to the left of the entryway, with a dining area to the right. The decor looked like it had been lifted straight out of a 70s sitcom. The walls were fake wood panelling, the carpet was orange and layered with colourful patterned rugs. Everything was well maintained, every surface was spotless. The air had the clinical, antiseptic smell of a hospital ward. Porter kept his AK-47 raised as he swept into the office. There was an oak desk with a chair behind it, set of keys on the desk, children's drawings on the wall behind, the kind of primary coloured scribblings that a proud parent might stick to the front of the fridge. Chintzy sofa pushed up against the wall, the cushions sagging in the middle. The Russians had already cleared the room out. The filing cabinets in one corner of the office had been emptied, the drawers ripped out and the contents tossed onto the floor. Next to the sofa, Porter noticed a bank of monitors. Each screen displayed a lumpy black-and-white image with a time and date stamp in the top left corner, like CCTV cameras relaying live feeds from the grounds around the orphanage. What kind of orphanage runs such a tight security operation? He stepped back from the office, turned to the right, and peered into the dining room. Empty. The moaning sound was coming from further down the corridor, he realized. He beat a path towards the nearest door on the left, the cries increasing in volume and multiplying in number. More than one child. Porter stopped in front of the door, twisted the knob. The door was locked. He swept past Bald, retraced his steps into the front office, and snatched up the set of keys from the desk. Hurried back down the corridor and tried the first key in the lock. He struck gold with the third key on the chain. The latch clicked. Porter yanked the door open. The room looked like a dormitory, he thought, or a holding cell. Bunk beds were pushed up against the walls, linoleum floor, metal bars on the solitary window, a single fluorescent light overhead. Then he saw the boys. They rushed forwards from their bunks as soon as the door cracked open. Porter counted 12 of them. Most of the kids looked roughly the same age as the child soldiers that Porter and Bald had seen in the jungle, except these children weren't sporting overdeveloped biceps. They were all painfully thin and dressed in tattered rags or frayed shorts. Some of the kids were whimpering. Others made strange, inhuman sounds. There was a bucket in one corner of the room overflowing with piss, piles of festering shit in another corner. How long have they been locked up in here? The kids flooded past the two blades in the corridor and scurried towards the front door in a mass panic. One of the boys moved slower than the rest. He approached Porter, hugging a frayed teddy bear close to his chest. The boy stared up at him with deadened eyes. He looked to be around 9 or 10 years old, Porter figured. He had pinkish scars on both ankles and wrists, and his arms covered with burn marks, like someone had been using him as an ashtray. His ribs protruded above his swollen belly. The boy opened his mouth and spoke in a tongue Porter didn't understand, some kind of local dialect, probably from one of the villages, probably spoken by a few hundred people in total. The kid saw the look of confusion on Porter's face and tried again, pointing down the corridor, towards the door at the far end.
"Kid's trying to tell us something," Bald said.
Porter moved down the corridor, a sick feeling of dread brewing inside his chest. He stopped in front of the next room along and tried the keys in the lock until he found the right one. A dozen more kids flooded out of the girls' dormitory, making the same desperate moans as the boys, their pink dresses stained with blood and dirt, their lips smeared with bright red lipstick, eyelids coloured with glittery blue eyeshadow, like some grotesque parody of a child beauty pageant. Porter continued to the end of the corridor. He swung open the door at the far end. It led directly through to the annex, bathroom and bedroom to the right, both modestly furnished, kitchen to the left, bright yellow walls, dark wood cabinets. Directly ahead was an open doorway leading into a wide living room roughly the same size as the dormitories. It was dark inside the room. Porter stopped just inside and fumbled for the light switch, found it, flipped it up. Three overhead chrome pendant lights switched on, bathing the room in a warm orange glow. The room had the same dated look as the front office. There was a vintage oval teak coffee table in the middle of the room, with three chintzy sofas arranged around it in a semicircle, a couple of armchairs. All the furniture was covered in clear plastic wrap. Bottle of water and paper cups on the coffee table, an ashtray overflowing with cigarette butts, a bottle of expensive vodka, half a dozen cocktail glasses filled to the brim with bright blue pills.
Viagra, said Bald.
Porter lifted his eyes from the cocktail glasses. There were dark, crusted splodges on the carpet, he noticed, with a quickening in his guts. More patches on the walls. Then he realized what the patches were. Dried blood. Bald said,
What happened here?
Porter said nothing. His mind was reeling. His shoulder wound throbbed. Nausea tickled the back of his throat. He stepped outside the living room, made his way back to the bedroom and glanced inside. There was a wardrobe with a sliding glass door, a single bed, and a bedside cabinet with a lava lamp on it. The floor was bare, except for a patchwork wool rug between the wardrobe and the bed. The bed looked newly made, the pillow unruffled, like nobody had slept in here for a while. Porter stepped back out of the bedroom and scratched his head, trying to make sense of it all. Then he saw the cables. A big bunch of them ran along the kitchen floor. The cables were black, thick as anacondas. They looped up to the window and fed outside, running through the long grass to the smaller outlying building to the rear of the compound. Bald had noticed them too. He furrowed his brow.
What's in there?
Porter shrugged.
Let's have a look.
There was a door at the rear of the kitchen leading outside. Porter and Bald stepped out onto a patch of bare ground behind the orphanage. Outlying building at their 12 o'clock, 20 meters north of the annex. What looked like a building site 5 meters to the east at their 3 o'clock. Porter guessed the owners were expanding their operations. The foundations had been laid for a new block, roughly the same size as the existing annex. A load of equipment lay around the kitchen door, a cement mixer, bricks, bags of cement. Porter and Bald moved past the building site and beat a path towards the outlying building. It was about a quarter the size of the orphanage, Porter figured. It looked shabbier than the main building, like an afterthought. The walls were bare concrete. The corrugated tin roof was coated in about an inch of rust. Power cables trailed from the generator shed to the building. No windows, Porter noticed. As he approached the door, he remembered something Tannen had told him back at the hotel, something that had been knocking around inside his head ever since, when she had mentioned the heavy security presence guarding the mine. Soames is hiding something, Tannen had said. Something big. There was a security camera fitted above the door. The door itself was a solid-looking thing, secured with a flimsy padlock. Porter took 2 paces towards the door and hefted up the AK-47. Then he brought down the buttstock of the rifle against the padlock in a rapid motion, smashing apart the rusted metal bolt and ripping the shackle loose from the latch. Porter planted his hand against the door and shoved it open. He heard footsteps pounding across the open ground at his back. He glanced behind. Soames and Tully were charging across the compound towards Bald and Porter. They were 20 meters from the manhole cover now, 20 meters from the 2 blades. Soames shouted at them to step away from the door, his voice carrying crisply across the darkness. Porter ignored him and stepped inside. Bald followed. They entered a wide, low-ceilinged room, dimly illuminated by banks of glowing screens. There were bits of machinery and components everywhere, keyboards, mice, external disk drives, like a computer shop selling off its stock. Miles of wire. A spaghetti tangle of cables ran from the backs of dozens of tower units to the power sockets. Computer fans whirred. Screensavers flickered on the monitors. The room was furnace hot, a result of housing a serious amount of computer equipment in a building with no natural ventilation or windows.
This place must be what the Russians were after,
Porter told himself. There was a CD burner on the desk next to one of the computers, plus a stack of discs. Porter browsed through them. All the discs were marked with dates scrawled across the aluminium surface in marker pen. The most recent ones were several weeks old. He picked up one of the CDs, punched the eject button on the tower, placed the disc on the tray and shut it. The CD drive beeped and whirred. Porter nudged the mouse to make the screensaver disappear. Then a media player panel appeared at the bottom of the screen. Outside the building, he could hear Soames shouting at him, ordering him not to touch anything. Porter blocked out his old CO's voice, hovered the arrow icon over the play button, and left-clicked the mouse. A black-and-white image filled the screen. The guest suite in the annex, dated 6 weeks ago. Three boys were running around the room. They were naked and around the same age as the kids Porter had seen in the dorm rooms. They were being chased by two older white men with cobwebbed hair. The old men were also naked. They pursued the boys round and round the sofas, saggy flesh hanging from their outstretched arms, faces grinning, like they were playing some depraved playground game. The image quality wasn't great, but Porter vaguely recognized one of the guys from Sky News, the Tory MP with the wire-framed glasses. The other guy was a retired army general. The general chased one of the boys around the coffee table, caught up with him, and then let himself fall on top of the boy, tickling his ribs. The boy wriggled and laughed, like any normal dad playing with his son, except the man and the boy were both naked. The Tory MP took no notice. He was focused on the two other boys, hunting down his prey. Then the general suddenly stopped tickling the kid. He wrapped his arms around the youth's waist and pinned him to the floor, pressing down on the kid's slender frame with his considerable weight. There was no audio, but Porter could see the kid's mouth widening into a scream, his arms and legs flailing as he kicked out at the old man. Seconds passed. The boy stopped struggling. The general kissed the child on the mouth.
"Jesus Christ," said Bald. "Jesus fucking Christ."
Porter heard footsteps. He looked up at the entrance. Soames stood in the doorway, exuding a strange calm. Tully stood behind him, watching Porter and Bald steadily. Porter's eyes wandered back to Soames as the latter took a slow step into the room.
"What the fuck is this place?" Porter demanded.
"I like to think of it as a private retreat," Soames replied. "Somewhere discreet, where certain individuals are free to indulge their fantasies, free of the moralizing constraints of Western society."
Porter shook his head, his throat tightened with anger.
"You're protecting a bunch of kiddie fiddlers."
"That's one way of putting it, I suppose. The individuals who frequent this orphanage are pillars of the establishment. Men who work at the highest levels of Westminster, the civil service and the military. We provide them with a secure, discreet environment where they can do as they please, no questions asked."
The blunt admission startled Porter.
"My old CO is operating a paedophile ring in the middle of the jungle."
He clenched his fists, his knuckles whitening, the nails digging into the palm of his hand. He wanted to punch Soames so hard his teeth would shatter. Bald said,
"You told us this was about diamonds."
Soames stiffened.
"I had no choice. The Russians were threatening my position. There was no time to explain everything. Besides, I didn't know how much you had been told about our operations here in Sierra Leone. It's only when you rescued me from the West Side Boys that I realized you didn't know about the orphanage. Obviously, you've both been kept in the dark by your superiors."
Anger clamped its fingers around Porter's throat, like it had him in a chokehold, cutting off the air to his brain. He felt an immense pressure building between his temples. More than anything, he needed a fucking drink.
"Why here?" he said. "Why Sierra Leone?"
"Well, simple," Soames replied.
"Life here is dirt cheap. No one asks any questions. No one causes trouble.
All that civil war, crushing poverty and lack of government infrastructure makes it easy to steal children from the villages without anyone kicking up a fuss. Besides, we had no choice but to shift our operations from the UK. Hosting these sessions in London was increasingly difficult. Too much risk of media exposure. I'm sure you've heard the rumours.
Porter nodded slowly. There had been the usual tabloid rumours, allegations of a Westminster paedophile ring that sexually abused young boys. Every so often you'd hear something on the news, some dirty old MP with a fondness for kids. Now he understood why Tannen had been so curious about the VIPs making unannounced visits to Sierra Leone, because they were visiting this place. Nausea tickled the back of his throat. Bald shot Tully a screw face.
You knew about this place?
Tully grinned.
Of course I knew, you dense cunt. I'm the day manager.
Soames saw the look of confusion playing out on Bald and Porter's faces and stepped in.
Bob's in charge of the day-to-day operations of the orphanage. He's been doing a fine job since he started working here, I must say. Keeps the children in check, makes sure they do their best to entertain our guests, brings in more kids from the surrounding villages whenever we need them.
Porter stared at Tully and felt sick. Dozens of children have gone missing, Tannen had said.
You took the kids, he said.
Tully grinned again.
Like I said, fellas, this is the best job I've ever had. Top pay, good hours, and the kids are dead easy to find. If any one of them step out of line, you cut them up and get another one. Simple.
There was a note of pride in Tully's voice and a sadistic gleam in his eyes. Porter looked away from him, nodded at Soames.
You're the one running the network.
Running is rather a strong word, I think. I merely provide the location, the transport, and the children. What my Westminster friends get up to behind closed doors is entirely up to them.
Porter glanced over at the monitor. On the screen, the retired general had moved over to the sofa, helping himself to a joint, while the boy lay in a fetal position on the carpet, weeping. The Tory MP with the wire-framed glasses sat on the other sofa, tugging on his flaccid penis, while another boy sucked on his toes. Porter looked away with a wave of revulsion. He glowered at Soames.
You're fucking sick. Once the firm hears about this, you're finished, both of you.
Soames smiled faintly.
I sincerely doubt it.
The fuck are you talking about?
A quick smile flashed like a knife at the corner of Soames's mouth.
Your handler really didn't tell you anything, did he?
Porter said nothing. The pounding between his temples grew louder. Soames took another step towards him. His smile broadened.
What do you mean? Bald said.
MI5 knows about this place already, you fool. They know what goes on here.
Porter felt a slash of cold air on the back of his neck. A shiver spider crawled down his spine, turning the blood inside his veins to ice.
Bullshit!
It's the truth, Soames insisted. I work for them. I run the orphanage on their behalf.
Porter shook his head furiously.
Why the fuck would the firm get involved in running a pedo network?
Soames waved a hand at the stacks of CDs and the computer monitors.
Look around you. This place is an intelligence gold mine. Everything that goes on here is recorded with secret cameras rigged up inside the building. Every buggering session is filmed. Every individual who abuses an African boy or girl is captured on camera, the footage copied onto disk and handed over to Five for safekeeping.
This place is a honey trap for pedos, Bald said.
One of several, actually. There are other sites similar to this one in South Africa, Canada, and Belize, among others. Not every diplomat feels safe travelling to Sierra Leone, naturally.
Porter shook his head.
The firm would never allow that.
Oh, really?
Soames chuckled easily.
Think again, John. There are paedophiles in every corner of government, more than you might imagine. Senior civil servants, army chiefs, cabinet members, the list is endless. Thames House decided long ago that it was infinitely more profitable to blackmail these men rather than report them. They provide us with intelligence, spying on colleagues, that sort of thing. The individuals concerned are in no position to refuse Five's demands, of course. If the footage was released, it would ruin them. He smiled. Why on earth do you think the Russians were so desperate to find this place?
The footage, Bald said.
Correct.
How did they find out about the orphanage to begin with?
Porter asked. One of the children escaped a few months ago. He ran off to the West Side boys and told them what was going on at the orphanage. The Russians got word through their rebel contacts and decided to rob me. They were going to kill me, take the footage, and use it to strong-arm our government. I couldn't let that happen, so I killed their agent, the man you found in my office.
Why would the Russians be so keen to get their hands on footage of a few dodgy old British pedos?
If the Russians stole this material, they would have cast-iron proof that MI5 was actively involved in running a top-secret paedophile network using war children. The fallout would be politically toxic. Five and Six would be instantly discredited, perhaps even dismantled. The knives would be out inside Westminster. Our national security would be put at risk, along with the hundreds of operations and thousands of field agents we're running around the world. It would be nothing short of a disaster. Soames paused. Which is why we must remove the CDs at once. Everything that is stored at this site has to be taken away.
What the fuck for? Bald said.
The orphanage has been compromised. No doubt the Russians have already notified their superiors at the FSB as to the whereabouts of the orphanage. This facility is no longer secure for our purposes. We'll have to relocate before reinforcements show up.
Where to?
Guinea. I own a ranch in the countryside. If we move now, we can make it across the border by first light. Once we're out of Sierra Leone, the footage will be secure.
Porter shook his head.
That's not part of our mission.
I agree with Soames, Bald said.
We can't let the Russians get their hands on this stuff, mate. If word got out, the press would have a fucking field day.
Why don't we just torch the material?
Out of the question, Soames replied. The firm has invested a lot of time and effort in running this place. The footage is too valuable to destroy.
Porter gritted his teeth. The pain in his shoulder had dialed down to a dull, constant ache, the blood sticky against his skin.
I don't mind being sent halfway round the world to a bloody war zone, he thought. I don't even mind having to protect the life of the guy who shafted my career. But I draw the line at putting my balls on the line to save a bunch of Westminster paedophiles.
Soames saw the look of uncertainty on his face. He made a sidelong glance at Tully, then looked back to Porter.
Call your handler if you don't believe me. He'll tell you the same thing.
There was a challenge in his eyes as he spoke. Porter hesitated and glanced at his mucker. Bald shrugged as if to say, your call. Porter set down his assault rifle on the desk, fished out the Russian satellite phone from his back pocket.
Sod it, he said. I'll make the call.
Soames looked relieved. He looked at the piles of CDs and wrinkled his features in thought.
Someone should head back down to the main road, bring up one of the wagons so we can load up all the material and computers. There's too much here for us to carry down by hand.
I'll go,
Tully volunteered.
Good man, Bob.
Tully hesitated by the doorway.
I'll need a weapon.
Porter frowned at him.
What happened to your collector's item?
The guy held out the M1911 pistol. He had the grip and receiver in one hand, the rust-coated slider mechanism nestled in the palm of the other.
Sliders fucked. I checked to make sure there was a round in the snout when you asked me to cover you both. Bastard snapped clean off. It's useless.
Bob makes a good point, Soames added. If the Russians have sent for reinforcements, he might run into them on the main road.
What about your secondary weapon?
Porter asked.
Left it in the wagon,
Tully replied dismissively. He turned to Bald, nodded at the AK-47.
Come on, Jock. I thought we were friends. Do us a solid, mate. I saved your arse back at the hotel. The least you can do is sort me out with the piece.
Bald wavered, then handed over the rifle.
Here, mate, take it. There's more than half a clip in there. Should be enough to send any more Russians packing.
Tully gratefully accepted the weapon and smiled at Bald. Cheers, fella. You're a good mate, you know.
Tully grabbed the rifle and stepped out of the building. Porter couldn't get a signal inside in an enclosed space, so he ducked out of the room too. Bald followed, then Soames. Porter flipped up the antenna and paced east towards the building site, pointing the phone skywards until he found reception. After 8 paces, 2 bars flashed up on the display. He punched in the number for Vauxhall that he'd committed to memory. Although the display characters were in Cyrillic, the numerical layout and graphics were broadly the same as the Motorola, and Porter had little trouble operating the handset. He hit the green icon for dial, then waited for the call to patch through. The phone rang and rang. No one picked up.
They don't recognize the number, Porter thought. They're not going to answer.
He was about to terminate the call when a voice on the other end of the line said,
Who is this? How did you get...
It's me,
Porter interrupted.
Porter!
Hawkridge spluttered. In the background, Porter heard the tap-tap of keyboards, the chorus bleeps of ringing phones. He imagined the agent sitting behind a desk in a climate-controlled office somewhere inside Vauxhall.
Where the hell have you been? We've been trying to contact you for hours.
Battery died, said Porter. We're at the mine. We've got Soames.
A long pause played out on the other end of the line.
Whose phone are you calling us from?
The Russians. One of them had a sat phone on him.
Another pause.
You fucking idiot. This isn't a secure line. The FSB is probably listening in on us right now.
What did you want us to do? Porter said. Our phone's dead. We had no other way of reaching out to you.
Make it quick, then. What's the situation? Have you secured the mine? If you're using a Russian sat phone, then I presume you've taken care of our friends.
Aye. The Russians are dead. We're at the orphanage now.
I see,
Hawkridge said, slowly. Porter said,
Soames told us about the pedo network.
I see.
He reckons the firm is helping him run this place.
Silence. The guilty kind. Porter looked across his shoulder at the front of the compound. He could see the security lights glowing in the distance, the dark oblivion beyond. He briefly wondered where the kids had gone. Perhaps Tannen and Solomon had seen them running out of the compound and come to their aid, he thought.
John, are you there?
You fucking lied to us.
There's no time for any of that now. Listen to me carefully. I'll make this very quick. Is Soames there with you now?
Porter looked back towards the outlying building. Soames and Bald were standing 4 meters away at the edge of the building site. Bald at his 2 o'clock, Soames at his 12. The ex-Rupert had his arms folded across his broad chest, a smile trembling on his lips. Tully was still there, too, standing at Porter's 10 o'clock and clutching the assault rifle he'd borrowed from Bald. Porter briefly wondered why Bob Tully was still hanging around the compound.
Well?
Hawkridge snapped.
Answer me, man.
Yeah, Porter said. He's here. Why?
I need you to kill him, Soames. He has to go.